Welcome to the Social Exchange Podcast, episode number 74. Today's guest is Kurt Jemungel. Kurt is the co-creator, with Des Jamila, of the documentary film Better Left Unsaid. The film shines a light on salient cultural issues that are difficult to discuss in a balanced way, at least publicly, namely the radical arms of both the left and right-wing politics. Better Left Unsaid explores leftist social justice theory and how it turned into censorship and orthodoxy, as well as right-wing nationalism, racism, and violence. In the film, Jemungel explores history and discusses what has happened previously when these cultural frameworks have been unchecked and were allowed to influence policy. He also offers a window into his own mind, how he thinks about and makes sense of these issues, and what any given person can do about them. Today, Kurt and I discuss these topics in detail as we explore ways to be a thinking and constructive citizen. You'll see that his thoughts and beliefs are well-researched, but they're also fluid and changeable. He struggles with his own ontological sense-making and takes no shortcuts when discussing difficult issues. He argues, at least tacitly, that struggling with an internal dialectic is a crucial process, albeit a painful one, for an individual who wants to be a critically thinking and relevant sense-maker. I enjoy the discussion, and I hope you will too. Here's episode 74 of the Social Exchange Podcast. Here with Kurt Jemungel. Kurt, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it, man.
So I know you as the person who created Better Left Unsaid, the documentary, who wrote it, acted in it, narrated it. And that's a film that I've watched maybe six or seven times now since I've downloaded it when it came out. It's excellent. It does a really great job of... No, that's not a good enough... It's sort of a masterful job of putting succinctly a lot of the problems that so many people are noticing when it comes to political ideology, both on the left and the right. Although I did see that there was a more of an emphasis on the left, but maybe we could talk about that in a minute. Before we do, let me do a you back to you and ask about your background. And I'd like to know how you got interested in both filmmaking and in having intellectual discussions with some of the more famous, prominent, life-changing sort of intellectuals in the world.
Yeah. So for filmmaking, when I was in university, I did something called, well, not something called, people will know what this is, stand-up comedy. And then from that, as you're a comedian, you often want to get on TV because you follow the model of Seinfeld and Chris Rock and Louis C.K. and so on. Mm-hmm. So I started writing scripts, but and I had the arrogance to think they were wonderful. But they got rejected from this place called Comedy Central in Canada. And instead of taking that with humility, I thought that that is an indication that they don't know what they're talking about. So how about I get it made? And then I learned how to film, how to direct, and how to produce, and so on. And I kept with that. For whatever reason, math and physics didn't appeal to me in university, though I'm so absolutely interested in math and physics, particularly with a subset of theoretical physics called grand unified theories, or something called a theory of everything. That's always been with me since I was a teenager. Then when I was in university, as you're told, you have to study so-and-so, then it becomes wholly uninteresting. At least for people who are on the more artistic end, people don't like to be told what to do. They find it much more engaging to approach it with their own volition. Once I left university, that was always in the back of my mind. I want to study math and physics. I want to study. But when I was there, I was just like, I can't stand it because I'm, for whatever reason. Then I started doing filmmaking after I graduated. But at the back of my mind, like I've been mentioning, there's been math and physics. So I thought, when I'm making this documentary, why don't I analyze it in the only way that I know how? So that is analytically, this whole situation of the extreme left and what constitutes extremism on the left. And then as I finished that film, and COVID hit, I thought, why don't I interview people based on math and physics like I've been interested in since the beginning? That's how the channel Theories of Everything, if people want to search that, Theories of Everything with Kurt Jemungel, that's how that channel started. And that's pretty much how the film, well, that's my answer.
I noticed that about you, that was very analytic, which is actually unique, it seems to me, in any kind of film, because usually you have
people who are very open-minded and want to be creative with their films. I like a lot of indie films, indie documentaries and films, which is great for me because I'm that kind of, I'm temperamentally oriented that way. But for somebody who might be more, let's just say conscientious or people who want to analyze, that's a brilliant draw for them. Have you heard anything, any responses from people who usually wouldn't watch a documentary like that?
Yeah, it turns out people who are more academic or academically inclined, they like the film. Mm-hmm. And then people who are used to more traditional films, they say it's like drinking from a fire hose. And it is. It's meant to be paused. It's meant to be rewound. It's meant to be talked about. It's meant for you to have mentation about. So mm-hmm. It's meant for you to pause and cogitate and so on. As for... See, in the beginning of the film was about 2.5 hours, almost 3 hours in its original cut. And there was an exordium where I talked about how films or documentaries usually have style with no, or emotionality without informational content. And that's the way that we work. We're engaged with style. But I thought, not to say my film has no style, but I thought, why don't I give information instead of, why don't I prioritize information instead of style?
Why this topic? What is the topic? What is the topic of the film?
In the marketing words, and then I'll give you my words. In the marketing words, it's an exploration into political extremism in the West. But in my words, it was answering the question as to when does the left go too far? And that's why you see it focusing on the left. And that's one of the critiques, which I despise so much, but you're welcome to bring it up and throw it in my face. But one of the critiques is, why are you focusing on the left when the right is a huge problem? Well, first of all, it would be like someone's talking about diabetes, like a doctor who's investigating diabetes. And then you say, well, why are you investigating diabetes when cardiovascular disease kills more people? Well, I'm interested in it. And for whatever reasons, personal proclivities, and I happen to be better at analyzing philosophical problems than I am at analyzing. Well, it's not, maybe I'm more interested in analyzing it. Maybe I'm not better, but the right seems to be less philosophical than the left. So there are plenty of reasons. We can get to that after. As for what the topic is, it's when does the left go too far, ideologically speaking? Now, one can say the left goes too far when they commit acts of violence. But that's, there's something that leads up to the violence. It's almost universal that people would say that someone goes too far when they physically harm you. Now, that's not, I said almost universal because there's obviously huge strains that think punching a Nazi or punching people or looting and so on is okay. The answer to the question is, the topic is, when does the left go too far, ideologically speaking?
It sounds like here and in other interviews I've heard you in the film itself too, what you're saying is, and this is not like a Jordan Peterson, what you're saying is, this is a reflection, you could disagree. The right, any ideology gone too far is bad. I think if the word bad means is meaningful at all, but the right, it's more like me bad, you good. The left is very sophisticated in the way that they go too far and the way that they're radical. Fair enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the right, at least to me, seems more overt in their nefarious qualities. They'll say that we care about supremacy of a race almost on the face of it. Now, sometimes they use couched language, but often they don't. And so it's more blatant, whereas the left is more nuanced, concealed.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Like what? I hear the terms critical race theory and postmodernism, and it seems right. It seems correct that, you know, everything sort of stems from those kinds of theories or ideas, or what would you call it? Meta narratives about the world. But maybe you could explain them a little bit. I'd like to hear further what that even means.
Okay. Critical race theory. I don't use that term in the film. postmodernism I use as a way of talking about how we went from what was pre-modern, although I don't think I talked too much about pre-modern, and then modern, and then postmodern. So to understand postmodernism, you need to understand modernism. There's a technical artistic aside here. It's actually not modernism, it's modernity.
Modernity, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but modernism refers to the artistic style of, well, it refers to a particular art style. But I use the word modernism because that's what people understand, and that's how people colloquially use it in their informal expressions. Okay. Do you mind repeating the question, please?
Only if I remember it. There are a lot of terms that I hear about what is at the foundation of the philosophies on the left that seem to go too far, that seem to be radical. And postmodernism is something that I heard you talk about in the film, at least. Another term that I've heard thrown around, maybe not by you, is critical race theory. And some would say that one is just a spawn of the other. Can you talk about postmodernism and really what
I won't it talk is? About I won't talk about critical race theory because I don't know too much about it. It seems to just be a term that denotes there are some races that are oppressed and you're allowed to discriminate up power hierarchy. So that means that if you're a minority who's oppressed, then you're excluded from being racist, and it gives you carte blanche to say heinous statements about someone else's race. That is, someone else's primarily being white. Although apparently it's bleeding into Asians, where if you're black, you can talk about Asian privilege and so on, but you can't talk about black privilege. There's no such thing as black privilege, apparently. Okay, so that's what critical race theory is. As for postmodernism, I don't see it as being pestilential in the same way that Peterson does. I see it as being what the... So here's a small innovation, let's say, of the film. I don't call them postmodern neo-Marxists like Peterson may. I call their theories postmodern inspired. And the reason is that they're technically not postmodernists. Postmodernists would reject any statement at all, basically, because you're making a claim to truth. Whereas, obviously, in critical race theory and the way that these theories are taught in the quote-unquote grievance studies in school, there is a narrative about truth. That is, that you're being oppressed. So it's not like you're relatively being oppressed. It's not like you can view it from some other standpoint and you're okay. Otherwise, why don't you just move to that standpoint where your experience of the world is more pleasurable?
If you enjoy the Social Exchange podcast and you currently don't contribute to the show, let me tell you two ways that you can make a contribution at no cost. For one, can you take just 1 minute to subscribe to the podcast and rate us on your podcast app? Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all those. Another thing you can do is to subscribe to our YouTube channel. We've only begun the YouTube channel and are currently putting out videos of our interviews on a regular basis. We are grateful for both of those things if you can swing it. At the same time, our show is supported solely by listener contributions. If you'd like to make a donation, you can easily do so at paypal.me/zeroads. I'll put that link in the description. And if you want to make a regular contribution, you can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesocialexchange. For as little as $2, you'll be doing a lot to support our work, and you'll receive exclusive Patreon content, as well as early access to all regularly scheduled episodes. Again, to drop us a tip, visit patreon.com/thesocialexchange. And as is custom, I want to thank all of our current Patreon subscribers. Thank you so much to every one of our patrons: Pat Casey, Jeffrey Singer, Dora, Stephen Rabinowitz, Jesse Dunleavy, Andrew Tatarski, Dean Lemire, Christy McPherson, Nuncio DeMartino, Susan Lennon, James Stacks, Chris L., Leon Nahufahu, Sherry Chandler, D.D. Stout, Christopher Hanlon, Henri Pompel, Carter Vermont, Rick Barnett, Ann Earl, Inigo, John, Layla, Mary Kay Villaverde, Michelle, Nancy, Sean, Regina, Timmy Tucker, Christian, Kathleen Cochran, Marjorie Israel, Diane, Trevor, Sue Matthew, Linda Rhodes, and Tom Rhodes. The latter three are my family members. And you know you're doing something right when your family members will support you beyond just morale, but financially as well. Thank you to all who have contributed to the podcast so far. If you'd like to join that list, then visit patreon.com/thesocialexchange. One more time. It's patreon.com/thesocialexchange. Now back to the show.
It seems like there's no way to collect as postmodernists to do anything meaningful in that sense. Like you could say that there's nothing real. There's no way to tell what's real or something like that. But
That's right. Yeah. And that's another reason why I was speaking to Michael Shermer, and I don't see how, and Michael Shermer runs a podcast and a magazine called The Skeptic Magazine. I don't see why he would have any problem with postmodernism. I don't see why an atheist or a skeptic would have any problem with postmodernism, because to me, it's skepticism to the max. If you like the skepticism of modernity, then why not just apply that a bit further and say, well, how do we know any truth at all?
What did he say to that? Did you ask him that?
Yes. Yeah. He basically said, well, you have to agree that science allows for truth. But to me, that's an assumption. And if you're a true scientist doesn't take anything for granted. That was the whole point of science, is you question everything, including what seems obvious. So if you're assuming that there exists an external world that's independent of us and that we can investigate it and gain knowledge about it, well, what basis do you have to assume that? Because have you heard of idealism? Okay, so idealism, for the people unacquainted, is this philosophical strain that says all that exists is mind. So that sounds ridiculous, because it seems like when I don't look at a cup and I look back, it's still there. However, you only have evidence of that cup when you look. Even if you were to film it with a camera, you only have evidence that it exists from you looking at the camera. So that means that there exists no fact independent of you. You don't know if there exists anything independent of you knowing it. You can't know it. You can't get outside your knowing. And so to me, that means that if one was being extremely science oriented, then, and science, it gets a bit complex, but science has something called Occam's razor, which is trying to reduce the amount of assumption one makes. If one takes that seriously, then I don't see how one doesn't come to the conclusion of idealism, because I know this is getting off on a tangent, but maybe it's interesting to some of the people who like philosophy. The reason is that for you to posit that there exists, look, right now we agree there exists mental states. You see me, there's a perception, there is an I, Descartes. Okay, so we assume that there's, we infer, or we can take that for granted, there exists mental states. It's another step to say that there exists an independent material world. That's actually two steps. So if you wanted to make a minimization of assumptions, that is Occam's razor, you can then remove that second statement about materialism and say that all that exists is mind. Then you would wonder, well, why are there physical laws? Well, you don't need materialism to explain that. You can just say there are regularities in mind. There are, just as there are regularities in the material world. And science actually doesn't say anything about whether or not idealism is correct or materialism is correct. Science is a method. So Michael Shermer was saying that science states that there exists independent fact and so on, but I don't see that as being at all settled or clear. I see that as being a jump that doesn't necessarily need to be made. That was his response, but that's my response to his response, which I didn't say to him at the time because we only had about 30 minutes. And just as an aside, if you're interested, I messaged him and asked him, hey, do you want to be interviewed for this documentary that I have called Better Left Not Sold? He said, he messaged me back within a half hour. He said, I'm actually in Toronto, Kurt, and I'm here until tomorrow night. Do you want to come down tomorrow at noon, or maybe it was later that day, I don't remember. Do you want to come down a few hours from now, essentially, and film me, because I'm being filmed for some other documentary in some place, and you can come afterward. We have the room booked. And I remember thinking, I just want to eat with my wife and just, I would love to relax today. I've been overworked for so long. I think I have an appointment with my, not an appointment. This is how horrible my brain is, that I treat my family obligations as appointments. Well, anyway, I have some, and I call it an obligation. Like, that's something I need to work on. well, regardless, I have to see my family later that day. Right there, have to see my family. I mean, I get to see my family later in the day is what I mean to say. And I thought, I'm not going to go. Maybe I can just tell Michael Shermer, I'll do it over Zoom like a week from now. I didn't even have the questions prepared. But then I thought, okay, Kurt, just write out the questions quickly. Go get your gear from your mom's basement or wherever it is. Just drive around the city and go take advantage of this. You have him in person. So I went in person and I only had him for about a half hour, but it was great that I was able to do so. Those
a half hour is an unserious amount of time to be able to get to the bottom of postmodernism versus idealism versus science, I suppose.
Right. And I didn't have my thoughts on idealism articulated actually at the time. I probably would have thought that idealism is completely incoherent and not worth bringing up at all. But when the more I think about it, I'm not saying I'm an idealist. I'm simply saying that if one wants to take parsimony in assumptions seriously, I don't see why someone wouldn't be an idealist. And that to me is an indication that perhaps we shouldn't take the minimization of assumptions extremely seriously. Maybe the world is fractal-like. Maybe it's onion-like. Well, we can talk about that after.
You know that we don't run paid ads on this podcast, and we never will. Instead, I'm going to give a shout-out to some of my favorite local businesses throughout the entire year in light of the difficulties that they've had to face during the coronavirus pandemic and beyond. I hope that some of my Vermont listeners will turn your attention to these businesses and consider taking your business to them. And when my out-of-state and international listeners are finally able to come to Vermont, I know that you'll check out these local businesses as well. This month, I'm giving a shout-out to Dick's Barbershop. Dick's is on Williston Road in South Burlington, Vermont. They're the real deal. They're community-oriented people. They give you a haircut and a shave. They listen to my and everyone else's bullshit stories and act as though they even care about them and believe them. And they're affordable. $15 gets you a quality haircut and shave, and you leave feeling like a new and improved human being. It's a father and son operation. The father's name is Dick. And I joked with him once that, hey, the place needs a slogan. He said, why don't you come up with one? So here's my idea. Dick's Barbershop. If you don't know good haircuts, you don't know Dick. He simply shook his head. Anyway, these guys were really hurting during the pandemic, and with the service they provide, they deserve to be thriving. If you live in Vermont, or if you're visiting and you need a haircut, or if you need someone to talk to about being sick of paying taxes or your marital status, and you don't mind getting a haircut as the ante for being able to tell that story, then visit Dick's Barbershop on Williston Road, South Burlington. Thank you for supporting Vermont businesses who have been hurting during this year filled with uncertainty. Remember to visit Dick's Barbershop, Williston Road, South Burlington, Vermont. Now, back to the show.
So in a sense, I mean, I have my thoughts about this. And just in short, I see science as being the only game we have in a practical way. You could maybe convince me otherwise. But it's in deciding what empirically doesn't work in a certain context so that you can build that out. And empirical is the key term there, I think. So that we can share that experience and make assumptions from there. It sounds like you're saying Michael Shermer, ironically, given the title of his last book, is not giving the devil his due. Because postmodernists, at least theoretically, are saying something similar, privileging parsimony the way that science should, and saying we should just believe nothing. And to me, I don't even have to argue the differences to say that postmodernism acted out seems impossible. What do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up some interesting points. One is that science works. So then what I say to that is you've used the word works, which is a pragmatic term. So then are you a pragmatist or are you a materialist in terms of your theory of what truth is? And I'm unsure about whether or not one can view the world through what is useful and what works, like a pragmatist may, and not subscribe to their view of truth. Or if you, I don't know, I still need to think about this. I've been thinking about this for maybe a year now, and I still haven't gotten my thoughts straight about it. But either way, you mentioned the word works, and you've also mentioned the word acting out, when it comes to postmodernism, that postmodernism acted out doesn't work. So just two senses of the word right there. But then again, that's pragmatic. And
doesn't fulfill its own theory of nothing, I guess.
Let's think about this. Okay. So the postmodernists would say that there are no truths, or at least let's steel man them and say that we can't know the truth. Maybe there exists truth, but we can't know it. I don't see why that is so far-fetched, especially to people who, like Sam Harris, who's extremely spiritual and likes Eastern philosophy, which is based in the fact that we can't know reality, that almost all that we see is likely illusory, or all of it is an illusion. And if one already takes that to be the case, then what's so outrageous about postmodernism? I'm not fighting for postmodernism. I hope you understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually
appreciate that you could easily regurgitate something that, let's say, Jordan Peterson says, that you are angry at the left, or whatever it is that you dislike or disavow or something, the left, by virtue of their postmodernism. But you're saying postmodernism may or may not be the problem, at least in theory. It intersects with science.
The problem may be what's called rationality. I'm speaking as someone who was a devout and ardent atheist from the time I was 8 years old until maybe just a few years ago. As for exactly what I am now, I wouldn't call myself a theist nor an atheist. I don't know what I am right now. I'm almost floating in a void of instability, which is not great psychologically or even physically. And I can talk about that another time. But regardless, I'm not saying that postmodernism is the problem. I'm saying that if one takes rationality serious, or skepticism seriously, or modernity seriously, it naturally leads to postmodernism. And I don't see why someone would believe in the values of the Enlightenment, but then not be naturally led to postmodernism. That's what I'm saying. So then maybe the problem isn't with postmodernism, but with its roots. That is the rationality of the Enlightenment. So then the question is, well, what are you, irrational? Well, we can talk about that.
Forgive me for being, this is probably much overly simplistic, but I imagine it's sort of the same thing as, in theory, communism, maybe Marxism, sounds okay. The idea of equality sounds good, or equity, or equal outcomes sounds good. Like, if it only could be actualized. We've never seen that actually happen. And so I imagine that's the same reason that rational folks, scientifically oriented folks, are against postmodernism or can't align with it.
Why is that? What do you mean? Okay, so you're saying that Marxism...
I mean, there's theoretical and then manifest, I guess. And postmodernism manifested as whatever it's become is what people are actually, like Shermer, are actually saying, I can't align with that.
Yeah,
and to pull back, you're actually saying what is being acted out on the left is not postmodernism.
Yeah, it's definitely not postmodernism, because they have an agenda that they agree to. So that's, and they assume that that's truthful.
So we need to talk more sensibly about, like, what is actually happening.
Yeah.
What this is.
Well, let's talk about Marxism. When you mentioned that it's actually, I wouldn't call it an okay idea. I call it a great, wonderful, beautiful idea if it worked. Now, here's the idea to not strawman communism, because Marxism is the philosophy behind communism.
Right.
So a communist state would be one where there's such an abundance that we no longer have to work in order to stave off privation and destitution and even social exclusion. So for example, there you can imagine a state of abundance where if you don't work, you're considered to be lazy and people don't want to associate with you. So let's imagine we can even solve that. That psychologically, you're not considered an inferior human for not wanting to exert effort where you don't want, where you don't need to or want to. That to me is an artist's dream. And when I say that, I mean, I was speaking to someone called Joscha Bach, and he said that in East Germany, so there's West Germany and East Germany. East Germany was the one that was, let's say, supposedly oriented by Marxism, and then the West was more of the West. So it matches up pretty great there, West versus East. He said that in East Germany, artists flourished. And I was wondering, why is that? Because I would imagine that artists would be clamped down and squelched by propaganda, that they can't fully express themselves. And he said, no, because the worst part of an artist's job is a job. The fact that they have to do something else to earn money, and they can't just explore. So now let's imagine you're given universal basic income, which essentially they had in East Germany. They didn't have to work. Well, whatever, you get the idea. That means it's an artist's dream. So there are some positive aspects to communism if in the way that it's written down. Then the question is, can you achieve that? It doesn't seem like any of the places that professed to be driven by Marxism or communism achieved something close to that. Now, there may be an exception, which is Cuba. Although I visited Cuba, and it's not like the people are uniformly clamoring to stay there. Not all of them are. It's not the picturesque idealization of communism like some of the people on Reddit /r/communism or /Marxism or /socialism would lead you to believe.
Well, I don't actually, you know, I told you I've seen the film 6 or 7 times, but maybe you only said this tacitly and you didn't actually say it. But insofar as the left is going too far,
yeah,
what is it that they're up to?
Yeah. Okay. When does the left go too far? Not to be coy, but around chapter 3 in the film, I give an answer where I make 4 stipulations, and I say, this is what unifies both the extreme left and the extreme right. It's number 1, so on. I don't want to spoil it for people, because that to me was the huge culmination of quite a bit of work, even though it seems so simplistic on the outset. Well, anyway, there are 4 bullet points, which I think I can condense down to 3 if I was to redo the film. Whatever, 3 to 4 points that unify both the extreme left and the extreme right. And I think they both go extreme when they follow those points. Broadly speaking, just to not be obscure about it, broadly speaking, it's when one views another group as abhorrently and inveterately, I wouldn't use the term evil or racist, because whatever, some negative quality, some deleterious quality associated with one group, and that group, what the unifying quality of that group is something that is constitutional and unable to be changed, and that intergroup communication is impossible. So that's, let's say, point number 2. And number 3, that the way to overcome this is with a revolution or violence in some manner, physical domination or exclusion in some manner. So those, let's say, 3 points are what I say characterizes the extreme left and the extreme right, coincidentally.
Can you give any good examples of that happening on the extreme left?
Okay. So let's take some of these protests when they say that white people are racist, or that okay, well, let's take critical race theory, where they say that white people are racist and you have people like you have power over people like, I don't know if I would be included in that because I've been called a white supremacist just by making this film.
Wow.
But whatever, you understand. I know, you can roll your eyes at that for people who are listening, with just listening and not watching. Let's imagine that. So that is them saying that you, because you're white or white passing, which is another interesting term, like Louis C.K.'s Mexican and Jewish, which to me would make him oppressed, but he's white passing, so he has all the power in the world. Apart from the fact that he's a great comedian who made plenty of money, so forget that. Even if he was poor, he has all the power in the world. Okay, so that's one where they say that there's a way to die. That's the way I like to describe it, because I'm trying to deal man them instead of straw man them. You have a weighted die in your favor. So every time you have an interaction or there's an opportunity given to you or taken, it's like you're rolling die and it's in your favor. So that means that sometimes you can get a string of ones instead of sixes and you'll be poor. But that's not what white privilege, that's not what they're saying by white privilege. They're saying that there's a weighted die and that, and they, I don't know why they don't explain it like this, because it would be more accepted.
That's a good steel man then.
Yeah. Right. So you have a weighted die. So okay, you're more likely to get a six than someone else. And this happens repeatedly at every interaction. It doesn't mean that you can't get a string of twos, and it doesn't mean that a black person can't get a string of sixes. It just means that as a whole, if you're white or white passing, you've been given this die that's weighted toward higher numbers. Okay, so that's point number one, which is there's a quality of you that gives you an advantage over other people, and that quality is one that you didn't choose. So that is your whiteness. You didn't choose that. Okay, so that's point number one. As for point number two, you see this with people saying, you can't understand my lived experience. So we can't talk about, sorry, we can talk, but I'm, as a minority, am to be believed. Not even that's somewhat false, because some people may say I'm a minority, like I'm brown, but on the extreme left end, it's not like they'll just believe the film because I'm a brown person. They'll just say that I've bought into the rhetoric and the power structures of the dominant white group. So they'll just clump me in with other white people, especially because I'm a cis male. So then they'll just, I already have two strikes against me out of three. So, okay, so that's point number one, is there's an inveterate quality or a constitutional quality of you that gives you a weighted die, let's say. But that weighted die isn't just, and excuse me if I'm getting too complicated or going on. Okay, no, so no. There's a weighted die that isn't, see, it's not as innocent as it seems. As I'm saying this, it sounds fun. It sounds like a video game or a tabletop game, but the die has to do with power and the opposite of power, which is being enslaved and so on. So it's not just you're likely to be given more money, but that money is tied to other aspects of capitalism, which oppress and so on. So this six-sided die is a stand-in for oppression. Okay, so that's point number one. Then point number two was that we can't have intergroup dialogue. Okay, so that one you do see already. Then point number three is to the revolution. As the revolutionary aspect of the left and the right, by the way, but we're talking about the left. You see this with them blatantly calling for revolution and blatantly calling for an overhaul of our system. Now, see, the point, this is something I've been thinking about when it comes to Satan, let's say, even if you're an atheist, doesn't matter, whatever. The most delusive aspect of Satan isn't that he tells lies. It's not that he's tricky or treacherous. It's that he sometimes tells the truth. Now that, or at least he appears to. Because if all that the devil said was falsehoods, then that actually gives you indication as to what the truth is, because it's the opposite of that, or at least not that. But when there's a bit of truth embedded within, then it means that you don't know whether to trust them. And you see this with spouses as well. You trust your spouse. You trust your spouse, but when they act untrustworthy, it's not like you can wholly untrust every single thing they say. There's a bit that can be saved in there, and you don't know what to save, and now you're trying to parse it out, and it requires so much effort, and it drains you, and it's hurtful at the same time. And that's one of the worst aspects of Satan, is that there's some truth, or at least the appearance of truth, embedded within the falsehood. Otherwise, if it was false, you could just completely ignore it, or at least use that as an indication as to where not to go. As for the extreme left, when they say that, and I lost my train of thought, so please, if you have any interjections.
What you're bringing up is something I've thought about, actually, while I was watching your film, which is that fundamentally, there are things worth agreeing with about even what the ideological left talks about, in my estimation. And when I hear Douglas Murray, for example, I think I noted this, and others talk about, well, the way to deal with a radical left, a left wing that's going far too far, is to just not allow it to happen. You know, you can, there's the reasonable concerns that you can deal with, that you can listen to, but then there's harassment and bullying and you just have to make it stop. And I think that that's correct in some sense. I mean, you can't, being tolerant doesn't mean you have to tolerate intolerance, I think was the quote. At the same time, I wonder if there's, if we should be, as you seem to be doing, really taking seriously fundamental concerns that people have. It seems like leftist movements or attitudes come from true concerns that people have and that they're not being heard. I'll just, sorry if I feel, if now I'm going on a tangent, but I work in the addiction field, but I also work with children, and often I'm tasked with de-escalating children. And when they're throwing temper tantrums, I do what, let's say, Douglas Murray says, and I don't allow yelling, I don't allow physical violence, I don't allow any of those things, but I do get them to the point where they can articulate their needs, and then I respond to those. And I wonder if there's a way to de-escalate a left that's gone too far so that we get to fundamental needs once. You know what I mean? And so that we can actually respond to those.
This is an interesting question. And it's a fun one to think about. So I don't know too much about what Douglas Murray would say. If you could tell me what he may say is the solution as succinctly as you can, that'd be great. And then I can use that as a point of jumping off.
Well, when I think about this stuff, I think it just comes as like a myriad of ideas and faces and images. So I might be misattributing this to Douglas Murray, but what I think I understand of him is that what he's doing through rhetoric and just good sense, I suppose, is saying, hey, when people are trying to accuse me of something or say that I can't have an opinion because I'm white, it's not happening. So, and I think he says that, you know, a lot of the reason why this can spread is because there are people who are insecure about standing up to a mob, and that, you know, if they did, maybe their reputation would be tarnished when it's perhaps a silent majority.
I understand.
We should see. Okay, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So what do we do? So there's two points here. One is that what the left brings up are legitimate concerns, and perhaps they're poorly addressed or posed by them, but right. That doesn't mean that they're irrational crybabies that need to be dismissed. A great way to think about this is one's stomach versus one's head. So you can think of your head as the top and you can think of the stomach as the bottom, or you can think of the head as the right and you can think of the left as the bottom. Sorry, the left as the stomach. And there are many different ways of thinking of this. This is a hierarchical example. One way of thinking about it is that the right, in Jordan Peterson's words, would be fortifying the hierarchy, and the left is saying that there are some people excluded in that hierarchy or that accumulate at the bottom. And what I see happening is that people on the center left, center right, center, and even the extreme right, they dismiss those on the extreme left as those who simply need to be more grateful. And if they were only more attuned to how bad life could be, then they would not protest in the streets. And thus, because the problem lies with them and not with the system or the state of the world, then we can continue operating as is. But I think that one should take protests as an indication that there's a lack, or there's something incorrect, something wrong that needs to be taken seriously, much like one's stomach. Just because you think you know better doesn't mean you don't listen to your stomach. If your stomach is growling, you listen to it. Now, your stomach may be craving sugar. So that would be, the analogy would be the protesters who are saying there's a concern here. And then you're like, what is the concern? They're saying it's sugar, or they're saying it's capitalism, or whatever it may be. And you're thinking, okay, well, that's false. Just like, yeah, you shouldn't be attracted to sugar. you have to take your stomach in the same way you take your stomach seriously, in the same way that the top needs to listen to the bottom needs to listen to the top. But the right would say, you at the bottom need to listen to us. And the left would say, no, 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 we're at the bottom. You need to listen to us. I would say that both need to listen to one another in the same way that there's a balance between the head and the stomach. And just because your stomach is craving sugar doesn't mean you need to repudiate it, but you can think of a salubrious replacement, such as, let's say, artificial. I know people don't like artificial sugars, or protein, or whatever it may be, but you listen to it and then you address it. There seems to be a lack of addressing on the center left, center and center right, and obviously extreme right, to the concerns of the extreme left, because they envelop their language with such animosity to white people that it's easy to just dismiss them as being hateful and invidious, but it doesn't mean that they aren't to be taken seriously. Donald Hoffman says this, has this great quote. Donald Hoffman is a cognitive scientist, has nothing to do with political concerns, but I'm going to take what he says. So he has this interface theory of consciousness, which says that we don't experience the world. We experience only a desktop user interface, is what he would call it. But that doesn't mean that in this, just because what I'm experiencing isn't reality itself, doesn't mean I can go in front of the train and just be killed. Because someone may say, well, if you think this is all false, that what you're seeing doesn't truly exist, then go in front of a train and kill yourself and see if that annihilates your existence. He would say, well, just in the same way that I don't take my email on my desktop as a literal interpretation of the email, because it's actually just circuits and electricity underneath, in the same way that I don't take that literally, but I do take it seriously, because I won't just drag that to the recycle bin and press empty. I take it seriously, but not literally. So that means that we can take the extreme left seriously, but not literally. And I don't think we do that. And as for Douglas Murray's point, I've been thinking about this for quite some time, and I can't find another way around an almost Christian or Petersonian solution, which number one is to stand up, but you don't stand up and say that the extreme left is insensate or unwise or untutored or obtuse or whatever it may be. Instead, you say what you think, and you say it lovingly. And then as for what do you do to stand up against tyranny, if you think of the left as tyrannizing you in some way, well, how about you don't worry about what they're doing, but instead you worry if you're being truthful enough in your personal life and honest enough and have enough integrity and loving enough in your personal relationships, and just expand that forward. So you see them as oppressing you in some way by calling you a hater. Sorry, not calling you a hater. Calling you an oppressor, let's say. An oppressor because you're white. Instead of saying, I'm not, well, you can say that. But you then think, well, how can I be more loving in my personal life? And that's it. And just expand truth and love in your personal domain over and over and over. Treat the elderly with more respect. Treat the homeless with more respect. Treat your concierge with more respect if you have one. Or treat those that you think are on the lower end with much more love and compassion. And just do that over and over and lead by example. I can't find another way to tackle the left or the extreme right than that. And I just can't. Maybe you can pose some other solutions. And every time I hear another solution, if I follow it, it leads to something that's worse. And I don't see the reason why I call this Christian. The reason why I call it Petersonian is because it's a personal take. You improve yourself at a small scale and hope that that expands outwardly. So that's what I mean by Petersonian. And what I mean by Christian is an emphasis on truth and love. And I don't see any other solutions other than being honorable in your personal life, not worrying about, again, the devil is in that there's truth to it. One story of Jesus that I love, and this, you don't have to be Christian, you don't have to, I'm sure there are Buddhist examples of this. One story of Jesus that I find so heart-wrenching is he was about to be tortured and put on the cross. People came to arrest him, and Peter, his friend, It's like, you're not going to arrest Jesus and cut off the guy's ear. And then Jesus said, no. And he took the ear and healed the people who were there to arrest him and hurt him and said, I've done nothing wrong, but I'm going to follow this anyway. And I'm not going to protest. I'm going to be loving. I'll tell you what you're doing is wrong, but I'm not going to fight you back. In fact, I'm going to show so much love that you're not going to know what to do. And then, well, there's so many different. Yeah, Zach, I can go off on so many different.
You're getting at what modes. You're getting at what I'm trying to get at as well. That it, to some extent, if you have values and you feel like they're being, if you feel like they're you and they are backed in a corner, only defending or acting in opposition is not sufficient to beat whatever's coming at you. It's more like what you're saying.
I watched this movie yesterday.
Yeah.
Love and Monsters. Have you heard of it? It's on Netflix. Apparently it's the number one movie on Netflix yesterday.
No.
Or so, or a couple days ago. Okay. Well, it's a kid's movie about, have you played Fallout from? Okay. So it's like basically Fallout in movie form. It's this kid in a post-apocalyptic world with a dog. And I guess there's been radiation. So some of the monsters have mutated and become some of the creatures, like a regular dog or regular ant or whatever, become huge. You have to fight them. And at the end, he was fighting someone who was just about to kill him and all his friends. And he looked at that monster, this huge, like frog-like monstrosity. And he saw that even though it was attacking him and attacking his friends and about to kill him, that there was good in the monster. And what he did was, instead of, he had the opportunity to kill the monster. He had a grenade or a gun that was about to be shot right in its mouth and that kills it. Instead, he took the gun with the one bullet he had and shot at its chains because it was enslaved by someone else and the person was using it like go attack. And he shot at it and said, you're free. And like that, and he was the hero of the story. And that's a hero. That's what a hero does, is even though someone is attacking you, you still help them. You still love them. You show grace and you want the best for them despite them wanting to beat you. And then you may say, well, imagine that was happening and you're a slave and your master's tormenting you. What are you supposed to do? Wash the foot of your master? Well, that's what Jesus did the night before he was about to get killed. And he didn't wash the foot of his tormentors, but his apostles, like, he's about to be killed. And he did that the night before. Now you may say, well, that's a story. It doesn't matter. That's the Love and Monsters is a story too. It's still inspirational, still an example of what, of heroic behavior. The reason why I'm struggling here is because it gets into the concept of what is an I. So what is you? Is you the you that dies? So if you die, your body dies. Imagine the master and the slave. And the slave is like, well, I want to get out of this tyranny, but at the same time, I'm not willing to hurt my master to do so. I'm not willing to be unloving or hateful. Mm. Well, you can imagine that slave just gets obliterated at some point. It was the slaves that had an uprising and stood up against the masters that ended up surviving. Is it though? Or is it? Well, I have to stop there.
It's all in balance, I suppose.
The reason I'm hesitating is because I don't want to get into too much of the philosophical conundrum as to what constitutes you. What does it mean that you live? So, for example, if you die doing a heroic act, but people then talk about that act and that influences others, that influences for generations to become. They still look back at that monument of you. You were the person at Tiananmen Square that stood up against the tanks, or you were the person that set himself or herself on fire. You were the person that crossed your arms and said, even though you're pointing a gun to me, I'm not going to protest. I'm going to say what you're doing is wrong. I love you. I wish you wouldn't do this, but this is what I believe. I believe that no violence, even me standing up with violence to stop your violence, I believe that you shouldn't do that. No violence. So I cross my legs and I have a gun pointed at me and maybe I die, but that inspires generations and generations. And it's, in a sense, you can think whether or not Jesus lived, the stories of Jesus also do that too. And we see this in modern examples with Gandhi and so on. So does that mean Gandhi died? Did Jesus actually die? So one might may say the body died, but the goodness in them lived on. And does that matter? Does the goodness in you matter more than the corporeal you?
So that's why I'm... To take that, to put that concretely, with respect to your film and with respect to the left, is it fair to say that the thing that you're struggling with here is that it might be the right thing to do to show love and compassion, even if you feel backed in a corner, because even if that doesn't help you in the moment, that those values and that goodness, to the extent that you have an idea of what good is, transcend those things. They could
wonderfully and live wonderfully on. Worded wonderfully and I love that you put it to the extent that you know what the goodness is, because that to me is something that in a sense we've lost since the Enlightenment, let's say. And I don't know if that's true. Maybe they also lost it before the Enlightenment, but after the Enlightenment we feel like we know what good is, we know what progress is, we know what evil is, though they won't use the terms evil, they'll say bad, or in the Sam Harris terms, something that's so negative that we need to move away from, but negative has its own ethical connotations.
I just got done reading that book, Moral Landscape.
Yeah, right. And in the word justice, so I saw this the other day about the guy who killed George Floyd. Mm. He was convicted for killing George Floyd. And some people said justice has been served. But I don't know if you should say justice has been served to anyone who gets acquitted or convicted, because to me, to say that justice has been served means you know what justice is, which means you know what the good is. And you don't know what the good is. And you don't know what evil, maybe you, I don't even know what, well, to know what the good is to know God. And I don't know if any of us know God. So I wouldn't be so quick to call what one is doing as justice. And that's why I don't like the term social justice either, because it implies that they already know their framework. No, someone may counter and say, but don't you know one as well, Kurt, because you're saying live by truth and love. So you're saying you know your ethical framework. Okay, but that's why I put truth in there. Because, okay, so love. This is super interesting about love. If you're in a relationship, almost each subsequent relationship that you have for a longer period of time, you say, I thought I knew what love was, but I love you. And I love, like, I've said I love you to many girls or many guys or whatever, but honestly, babe, when I'm saying it to you, it's at a completely different level. So what does that mean? It means that you could be wrong about your idea of love. And it means that, but you still need to orient yourself by love. So it means you have a gut feeling about what love is. It doesn't mean that because your gut feeling can be led astray, you shouldn't follow it. No, follow your gut feeling of love and follow what you think is truthful. Now, if you don't know what truth is, this is why I love Peterson's rule of don't lie. I love that rule more than telling the truth, because it's hard to tell the truth, but it's much easier to know when you're lying and to stop that. Well, sorry, it's not easy to stop it, but it's much easier to identify when you're lying. So either way, so you're saying, Kurt, well, you're saying you know your ethical framework because you're oriented by truth and love, but I'm saying no, because even those are suspect to change. So you follow them, and hopefully a society of people oriented by truth and love grow what love means and grow what the truth means, and they approximate it in some way.
Is that part of the too farness of the left, is that the ideas are preordained, unchangeable doctrine?
Right. So that is interesting. Yes. So when you have scripture or precepts that don't have an updating mechanism, then, well, let's just say that what you said is correct. Yes.
Good enough.
At least
for me.
I think so.
How's the right go too far? I mean, okay, in your terms.
Yeah. The right goes too far in the same way that the left goes too far in chapter 3, where I outlined the 4 points, although I think I could bring it down to 3. The right goes too far there, except they have racial superiority. That's the only difference. And I spoke to Daniel Bonavac. I spoke to Daniel Bonavac about this. He's a professor of philosophy. He said, after watching my film, he's like, yeah, it doesn't seem like, it seems like the right and the left go too far, but then what do you, what distinguishes the right from the left? He, and I agree, he seems to think it's just about race or nationalism. You can make it each, either one. And I seem to agree. I think the left and the right are the same, except one is nationalistic slash racist and the other is not, let's say. Okay, as for when the right goes too far. Well, that's that. That's when the right goes too far.
You mentioned racism. And yep. Does this seem silly? I don't really know. It seems to be an evolving definition. What is racism, do you think?
Okay, so racism simply means, at least to me, discrimination based on race, or to be mathematical, that you have some function as to how you are to behave or to think of someone, and you condition upon their race, and that's different if you were to condition upon their race. So that means you take race into account and you act differently. So that's what racism means. Now, see, to me, I'm racist in the sense that, well, firstly, I said this on another podcast, and then Desh, the producer of the film, he's like, oh my gosh, Kurt, why are you saying you're racist? You know that this can get, people will just clip this out, and the film is already.
Well, the definition going, you just gave does not sound pejorative.
Yeah, yeah, and
necessarily.
Like, I'm for, not affirmative action. What's the other one? Representation. I'm for representation, and the reason is because. Like I'm for it, but I'm against it. And I'll give you the for. And as for the against, I'll just save. The for is that Chris Rock said that he couldn't become a comedian until he saw Eddie Murphy do it. Now then that just begs the question, what did Eddie Murphy see? Maybe Richard Pryor, but then who did Richard Pryor see? Either way, Chris Rock meant that there was a black person killing it in the comedy game. And he would not have thought that he could become one unless he saw that. No, that doesn't mean that we should buy the government instantiate representation or affirmative action. It just means that you can decide if you think that's important, and that, well, it is racist in a sense because you're preferencing some other race. It may be sexist because maybe you're preferencing women or men. Let's say it's a movie where there needs to be a maid, and traditionally there'd be a woman for the role, but you're like, well, I want it to be a man so men can aspire to be dishwashers or whatever it may be. You understand. So it's in some way, in many ways, I'm sexist, I'm racist, I'm all the isms. So that's what racism means to me. Obviously, to the left, just so people know, the new definition of racism to them, though it's, as far as I could tell, still hasn't made its way to the dictionary. The definition that they're using is old definition of racism, so that is discrimination based on race, plus power, meaning that if you're the race that has more power, you're the only race that can be racist. If you have little power, you can't be racist for some reason. And then there has to be a third stipulation that people don't say, that they just assume, but I'm going to make it explicit. And the third is that white people do have the power. So they have to assume that otherwise, so look, there's three. Discrimination based on race. Number two, that the power gradient definition of race. So you can only be racist from the top down, not bottom up. And then the question is, well, who's at the top, who's at the bottom? So that's why you need number three. You need to say that there's a certain race at the top.
You've answered this already, but say more. Have you been unjustly accused of being racist?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to say unjustly again, because I don't know. I don't know what just is, so maybe it's completely just all the accusations that have been thrown at me. Maybe they're all correct. It's not for me to determine what justice is or what is truthful. That's not up to me, so I wouldn't call it unjustly.
So when someone throws racism at you, you're a racist in a pejorative way, do you cop to that or no, or just not necessarily? And no, you try to think
what
about
I do
it.
What I do, and I don't know if this is correct, but let's say that's a one-on-one situation, which has happened a couple times, though not face to face like this, if you can call this face to face, but not on videos, mainly text, like comment sections and so on, is I'll ask them questions and then they just stop. They don't like to respond. The reason I like to ask questions is that See, you're interviewing me right now. And in some way, I'm extremely uncomfortable with being interviewed. And the reason is that I have more questions than I have answers. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm look at how humble I am. Look how little I, look how much I know that I know so little. I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm just curious. So when someone says, you're racist, I want to know, well, what did I say that was racist? And then they say, well, you said so-and-so. Then I said, well, if someone said so-and-so in this context, would it be racist? And I just have questions upon questions, like a foolish kid who knows little. So I just tend to ask questions to people and they stop. Here's one that's fun. I was speaking with, I had two podcasts on January 6th. So that is the Capitol riots. No idea the Capitol riots were happening. I still don't know if Trump was the instigator of that. I know people say that, but I remember looking at Trump's Twitter feed in between when someone said, with the story I'm about to tell you. But either way, after I looked at Trump's Twitter feed and said, please peacefully do so-and-so. Please respect our police officers. Please don't be violent. And then Twitter banned that. And then they banned his whole account. So I don't know if Trump was the instigator. And then I'll probably be called racist just for saying that because people hate Trump so much. Mm. Whatever. January 6th, I was talking to a couple people for podcasts. Got a Facebook message from someone who was a fan of Theories of Everything, the podcast on consciousness, theoretical physics, so on. And they said, hey, Kurt, I know about your documentary and I want to know, why are you not speaking out against the violence that's happening on the Capitol, on Capitol Hill right now? I knew so little about Capitol Hill. I thought people were misspelling the word Capitol every time that I saw it, because I was like, what the heck is Capitol? Whatever. Then I said, well, what's happening in Capitol Hill? They're like, I can't believe you're... I'm like, I don't know about what's happening, so I can't say, I can't condemn it or approve of it. I just don't know. And then they're like, yeah, that shows that you've been a white supremacist or white supremacist adjacent or a bigot for the right all along. Then they just blocked me on Facebook. And they were a huge fan of the podcast before. That's the kind of interaction I get, or at least I used to get.
That's super interesting. This shouldn't be the most interesting part, but I've seen your podcast. I've listened to and watched your podcast. You would imagine that someone who's a fan of what you're doing wouldn't be so dismissive on that issue. But I suppose that's the power of buying into, unquestioning, buying into some sort of an ideology.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
My attitude... My true attitude is not going to actually reflect what I'm about to say, but I have 15 more minutes because I've got to pick up my daughter and I have more questions.
How old are you?
34.
Oh, okay, cool. I'm 32 turning 33 and I'm thinking of having a kid. How old is she?
You should do it for the reasons you mentioned before. Like everything that I do now is in terms of how it can transcend beyond me. She's 2.5. Yeah.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. So you had one is about my age. Okay. And someone said to me, why aren't you an antinatalist? Do you know what antinatalists are? People who think you shouldn't have kids because the planet is so horribly messed up. Well, we can talk about that after. You have 15 minutes. So why don't you ask the questions you have for me?
I'll bundle them. Yep. Let's say, like, I imagine that the film, it's informational, educational, but it seems like you have a bent, which is, we should do something to not let things get carried away rather than let things get carried away. But let me not assume that. What would happen if we just kind of watch things unfold, but don't actively try to do anything about either the left going too far or the right going too far? In a pessimistic view, like, what are you worried?
Okay. Let's imagine the left goes too far. What I would hope would happen is that they end up being correct in all of what they say, because if they're false, then reality doesn't care about what you think is true or false. It is what it is. That's almost a definition of truth in a sense. Reality is what it is, and it swallows falsehoods violently. So if they want to impose a falsehood upon a large group of people, then I just hope that falsehood ends up being a truthhood. Otherwise, it's not going to end well. So that's what I would hope. If what I see on the left or the right keeps progressing. As for what I hope for, some people have asked me this, what are you advocating for with your film? And I don't know how to answer that because I'm not advocating for anything. And the film was more an a dissertation in a sense of here's my thought process and I'm going to lay it out in video form. So here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I was thinking at this point, and here's how I'm thinking about this and so on. Like an introspective, a projection of my inner state. As for what I advocate for, maybe it would be that people don't lie at all, at all, at all. Never, never, never lie. And as much as you can, as much as you can, it's so hard to do, but to be loving. And the people, it's like, well, why is that hard? Oh man, you try to be loving. It's actually extremely, extremely difficult. Mm. If it were easy, if it was the easiest thing, we'd all just be in a hippie commune right now. So it's not easy to love, especially if you're someone who, well, if you're human, it's not easy to love. It's not easy to love. It's your wanton competitive nature comes out and you just want victory, especially like you can see this when you, well, I can see this when I fight with my spouse, and I don't fight when I verbally fight with my spouse or we get into an argument. Well, I don't, it's, I'm such a little invertebrate recreant craven that wants to hide and have the other. I'm like, I'm such a girl when it comes to that. Now I'm sexist, whatever, you know what I mean. I'm such a, let's say, a gutless poltroon that I go inside a room and I retreat, and what I'm hoping in the back of my mind is that my wife comes and says how she's sorry. And it's so difficult for me to then think, no, you go and tell her that you love her and that you're sorry first. That's so difficult. But to get back to the film, if I was to advocate for anything, it would be to not lie as best you can. Never, 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 never lie. Even the smallest instances where you think it matters the least, like you're returning an item to Amazon and you bought it just because you want to use it temporarily and then return it, and you know they have a, and then you lie about the reason why you returned it. Well, that's easy because it's remote. It's over text. Don't lie. Never, never, never lie. Don't lie about... The other day I lied at the store, and I don't want to... Let's just say that someone, they charged me for an item, and then they undid the charge, but they forgot to rescan it. And I saw that, and it was just $3, let's say. But then I remember being there, should I tell them? Like, I can save $3. Should I tell them? No, I'm not going to tell them. And then I left. And then I just felt so horrible. Like, I'm not saying that because, like, wow, look how much of a moral, upright person I am that depriving someone of $3, even if they're a large corporation, it weighs on me. I don't mean that. But it, at least the more that I tell the truth, the more that my moral compass does tug on me. Mm. And so then I had to do something where I was like, okay, I don't want to go back to the store and tell them that I stole. So what can I do to make this right? And I had to close my eyes and consult my conscience. And it said, okay, give more money. So more than $3, maybe $5 to someone else who needs it, like a homeless person. So then I went and gave $5 to a homeless person. And the reason why I'm reluctant to say that is because I have a feeling what I'm doing right now is undoing the good I did, because I think the good that you do is personal and private. Yeah. And the fact that I just made it public means I've undone it, because I know that there's a part of me that wants to get some points from the audience and say, wow, look at what a great person Kurt is. So because there's a part of me that wants that, then now, thank you, Zach. Now I have to give another $5 to someone.
Of course, if someone objective, well, you know, a few thousand people will listen to this, and maybe some percentage of them will take that on as good advice. So maybe you don't have to pay $5.
Maybe. We'll see, Zach. And I'm going to charge you for that. So yeah, if I do.
No problem. Well, so, but what if we do nothing? I mean, what if people who maybe should be doing those things you mentioned do nothing, and the ideas that are allowing the right and the left to go too far continue to happen? What would be a bad outcome? What's an outcome that you think is realistic and bad?
I think that whatever we've seen in the past can happen again. I don't see any reason for why it can't. If you look at, let's imagine that we were in the 19, let's imagine it was 1900 or 1905. Let's say Einstein publishes papers. You would think, well, the worst people can do is torture a few tens of thousands of people in the name of religious domination, like in the Crusades and so on, or the Inquisition and the tribal expansion of one's domain, like in Genghis Khan and so on. But then all of a sudden, the 1940s, there's huge suffering in the 1950s, huge suffering, and even into the 1960s. And that in many ways trounced what came before. But if you were to just go by previous history, you would think, well, it can't get worse. We're only progressing. So I don't see any reason for why we think it can't get worse because we're somehow more enlightened. In fact, in many ways, we have the capacity to destroy ourselves. And even going to Mars doesn't, like Elon Musk is like, we got to get to Mars because we have to get away from the nuclear threats on Earth.
Then we don't get away from ourselves, though.
It's not as if you can't send a nuke to Mars.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's so out of the question. People are thinking about putting nukes orbiting the Earth anyway so that you can attack any point on the planet virtually at any time. So why can't you just send a nuke to Mars? It's not like you've escaped Earth's violence. Well, anyway, that's what I would say about that, is that if you allow, it's not just left and right, it's people in general, if you allow, and yourself in general, if you allow this violence to overwhelm, and this vindictive quality, and this hateful quality, and this unloving quality to dominate, then see, the hate has to end somewhere. I'm sorry, I know that you have to end somewhere, you have to get going, but this is something so, it's crushing to think about. Think about if you were physically abused from your parents, why? Well, sure, maybe you were a bad kid, but probably you didn't deserve that. And it's likely your parents were abused. And then how far back does that go? So then you can think about it. Well, there was some, let's call it evil or hate or hurt that happened at some point that just gets progress. So what are you going to do? The fact that you were hurt, are you then going to put that on your kid or hate your parents? Or are you able to take that hurt and then meet it with love? Because if you don't meet it with love, it will go. The hate has to end somewhere. And so if you're only willing to show love to people who show love to you, like, I'm not going to respect the extreme left because look at what they're saying to me. Well, that will spread. The whole point is to meet hate with love. And that's what I mean when I say you have to be truthful and loving, and it's extremely, extremely, extremely difficult. That's what I mean, is that you have to meet the hate with love, and that's not easy. Not easy at all. I struggle with it, and I'm not well, that's enough.
This might be an appropriate segue, because I want to know, as I'm watching the film over and over, I keep thinking this is like, these are bad paths down which we are kind of fated to wander, rather than this is like history should just serve as an example and we should be careful. I can't help but get out of my own head, like, oh no, here's the path we're headed down. So if you could, what are ways in which we're not fucked? Or why are you optimistic? Are you optimistic?
I waffle on that, because if I say I'm optimistic, it's almost fatalistic, and same if I say that I'm pessimistic. And that means that it gives an excuse for people to not change, or even myself to not
like change. Our attitudes actually influence outcomes.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. See, that's one that I may write a book on, is self-fulfilling prophecies, because I have a feeling that they're far deeper than people think in terms of consequence, may even be tied to free will. Maybe the free will is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, I have to think about that some more. But either way, what are some ways in which we're not doomed to undue suffering? Let's think. Are we fated to that? No, I don't think so. I don't think we are, and I don't think you think we are, otherwise you wouldn't have had a kid. I mean, that'd be extremely horrific if you thought for sure we're headed in a dark place and then you bring your kid into the world. So I think that with your actions, you don't think so. I think that with the actions of even the people who, I don't know the answer to that, man. There's so many, every, I keep interrupting myself
because you're thoughtful.
It's like one thought, sure, one thought ramifies into quite a few that are contradictory, and I'm trying to sort them out in my head in real time, as well as to say what's coherent. And it's not easy for me because I'm also not only dealing with the thoughts, but then questioning the reason as to why I'm saying what I'm saying. And is it for a positive reason or is it to inflate my own ego, or is it to retreat so that I don't have to perform some other action that I think is hard, but I'm justifying it so that I can take the easy way out? And you may wonder, how the heck does that relate to anything that I've said? Well, it's personal, and I see it with almost each thought. So I'm questioning my thoughts, and then I question the contradiction between them. Then I question the motivations behind them. So when I'm interrupting myself, it's because I'm a deeply insecure and uncertain and inept person that's trying to minimize all those qualities.
When you're at your most relaxed about this topic, what are the thoughts going through your head? Maybe you can tackle it that way.
So first of all, I don't know if I'm rarely relaxed. I try to be. As for when I'm at my most relaxed, what do I think? How do I think about this issue? I think when I'm at my most relaxed, I'm just spending time with my wife and loving her and looking in her eyes and making sure that I'm not compelled to check my phone. And it's such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful feeling to be connected to someone, whether it's my family or my wife or whatever. And maybe that's, even though it sounds disconnected, maybe that's a solution to be loving. I wouldn't say to be present. I'm not a fan of that. But to answer the question, when I'm at my most relaxed, firstly, I'm rarely relaxed. And number two, when I am, I'm not thinking about it. So I don't have an answer to that.
We'll have to keep thinking about it. Kurt, thank you so much for your time today. I love talking to you, and I love the film and the podcast, and it's a pleasure to get to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you dealing with my extemporaneous verbal cascades, because I'm trying not to give an answer that I've given before or an answer that I don't think in the moment is truthful. And so it means that I have to generate it on the spot. And then generating it doesn't generate one, but it generates three, four, five, or two at least two. And then there's a vying as to which one is right. And it's not easy for me. So thank you for putting up with that.
I appreciate the care that you give your answers. But I'll tell you that my wife is going to laugh, because this is the kind of like dialect of the guy that I have with myself, what you're doing. I do this all the time out loud every day. And so, you know, after my own heart, your documentary is Better Left Unsaid. The podcast is Theories of Everything. Anything else that I could or should link people to?
No, I'll restate it. So Better Left Unsaid is the documentary that was just released April 2nd or whatever. And it's about when does the left go too far. If you want, you can buy it from betterleftunsaidfilm.com. That one gives more of the money to the filmmakers. It's also the international link. So iTunes and so on isn't in Germany, for example, at least not for Better Left Unsaid. So you can buy it from the website. More of the profits go to the filmmakers, as well as you get access to a director's cut, which has 30 minutes of extra material for free on the betterleftunsaidfilm.com website. As for if you're interested in, for whatever reason, interested in seeing me interview other people on the topics of theoretical physics or consciousness or God or free will, I have a podcast called Theories of Everything. And you can search that on YouTube as well as iTunes and so on. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you again.